All right, so today is going to be a pick a question day, but I thought I first would say a few words about Jukai in case there's anybody present who isn't really familiar with the way that we treat Jukai in this lineage, and or if you are more of a senior. You can listen to how I explain it, and you can kind of put it in your mind for when you need to explain it to people. So Jukai is essentially vows where you formally become a Zen Buddhist, and it's totally optional. All of our vows are optional, so. Anyone is welcome to participate with Bright Way. You are welcome to become a member. You are welcome to attend to classes and come to retreats and all of that kind of stuff. And never take that step if you don't want to for one reason or another. If you do want to, it entails studying our precepts, which are the moral. So we kind of say moral guidelines. It sounds really wishy-washy, right? It sounds like, if you want to. But the way that we view our moral precepts, do not kill, cultivate and encourage all life, do not steal, honor the gift not yet given, goes on from there. We see them as descriptions of enlightened behavior. So they're kind of like mirrors in our practice. They're tools of practice in a sense, rather than rules just to be followed, because otherwise you'll get in trouble. Although, you could approach them that way, because usually if you break precepts, you do get in trouble one way or another. So they can be approached that way, but at a deeper level, they are tools of practice, which is why we study them every year. So, we spend like 10 weeks studying the precepts every year, and different Sangha members lead the classes. So every year we revisit them and, look at them as just a rich part of our practice, including self-study. So, and you can study the precepts, you can keep the precepts, you can consider yourself a Buddhist without having to take this formal step. But for many of us, for different reasons, different people have different reasons for wanting to take the step. I don't know. For me, I felt like I could use the additional moral support, if you will, of like, standing up and saying, this is my intention, which is the same reason why we have, something like marriage vows that are publicly witnessed in a way where, other people help us hold that intention. So I kind of liked that idea of saying this is publicly my intention. And there's a way too that it kind of informs your own, strengthens and informs your own intention, because kind of once you've done that, you can't ever like deny that you've done that. Even if you change your mind and you don't want to be a Buddhist anymore, right? At some point in the past, you said, and there's a way that just kind of, for yourself, making that marker can be significant, as opposed to just kind of vague intention, just vague intention to be good, But to say like, no, I at some point I said, yes, I'm gonna try to do this. Which reminds me also of a question that a lot of people have, which is, they look at this list of precepts, including do not indulge anger, do not be mean or stingy with dharma or wealth, which they get, do not praise self or blame others. It's not as concrete and simple as not killing. And people are like, I don't think I can keep those. And so people hold off sometimes because they don't want to make promises that they can't keep. But the good part, Yeah, it's we take the precepts seriously, but we also understand that it's a process, that it's like we can't keep them perfectly. And that what is it? I didn't actually say this, but somebody else in a precept class this year, I guess, said it's like it's enough that you want to keep them. Right? It's about your intention. Not about how well you do on some kind of scale, but this is how you want to structure your life. These are your aspirations. So it's not necessary to be perfect. There's various things like do not kill. Does that mean you have to be vegetarian? There's lots of Buddhists in the world who are, but essentially, like, no, because we don't decide that for you. And we don't even imply, right? We don't even imply, like, well, no, it's up to you, but if you were really a good Buddhist, some things are very like, don't kill people. Like, we're don't kill people. You begin to recognize there's this whole spectrum all the way from killing people to just rejecting anything, rejecting even our own thoughts and feelings and experiences. So there's that whole gamut of breaking this precept, which the precepts don't give us like, oh, now I know all the answers and I never have to think again. In fact, they put us right in the middle of a moral quandary many times. What is this? Is this stealing? Is this not stealing? Is this misusing sexuality? Is it not? It's not an easy thing. So yeah, and then the other one that people often get stuck on is that do not become intoxicated. Polish clarity, dispel delusion. And some people are like, okay, does that mean I don't drink alcohol anymore? Again, there, I mean, like fully ordained Buddhist monastics don't drink alcohol. The rest of the world, we're all over the map. So that is again like, what is your own manifestation of that precept? At what point, is something like alcohol or drugs or any other intoxicant, really compromising your life and clarity and practice? So it's often helpful to just, take the vows and see how it shapes your life. And then another aspect of vow, which I can at this point I can just open it up to and people can talk about it if you want, but is like joining the Sangha, if you like. Like I said, you don't have to do it, but there is a like when you wear the Wagesa, which hey, Greg, would you lift yours up a little bit so we can see? There's a Wagesa. That's the, it's like a strip of cloth with a decorative knot. And that people who receive Jukai receive one of those, as any of the garments that we wear in Zen, like the Rakusu, as it are signs of vows. So you can wear the Wagesa as a sign of your vows to receive and keep the precepts. So, I mean, it's just kind of it's another way of deepening your sense of connection to and support of the Sangha. So, yeah, I mean, I don't want to necessarily talk about this all day because we've just gone through a long series of precept classes. If anybody feels particularly inspired, if I've kind of left something out about like reasons why people might be taking this step next Sunday, or if you have any questions, now's a good time. Go on to another topic. So another little topic that I wanted to get out of the way was, and I had mentioned this some other day, and I plan to write something up for the website and whatever, but and I don't mean to put people on the spot, but I would love to see people's faces on Zoom when you are present. And sorry, and now I feel like this is always awkward to bring up because it's kind of like, oh, let's see, where were you? Whatever. Like, this is not it's not obligatory, don't be weird about it, but do consider if you are in a place where you are willing to turn your camera on. And it's not just those of you in the cloud. I mean, almost everybody here in the Dirt Center also is online at times. So talking to everybody. Because it's like when we are sitting here in the Zendo, we don't know if you're there.
That's right.
Which is kind of like, I mean, that's cool. I see your name, and I'll give you the benefit of the doubt, but we don't know if you're there. And frankly, I mean, I've been at home. I've been in the cloud plenty of times. And like, if there's a really boring meeting I'm on, turn that camera off. I mean, that's one of the benefits in a way of being in the cloud. Paulette, I was listening but gardening at the same time. Well, there you go, Paulette. That is a very good excuse. That is fine. I mean, whatever. Take it all with a grain of salt, and do what you want to do. But know that it's like the rest of us in the cloud, the rest of us in the dirt Zendo, like to see you. We're like, oh, you're there. Like, neat. Sometimes, like, you have a pet that's like getting in the way or whatever, and you can, turn it off, what have you. And just another thing is, and Amelia, I turn my camera off because when it's a larger group, I tend to get static. That's another. Thank you for mentioning that. So that we understand there are different reasons why people have it off. And then sometimes, if we have any problems with bandwidth in the Zendo, then we might ask you to turn your cameras off. But one note that's very helpful, if you are in the cloud, is to just be aware if there's a ceiling fan behind you, or like maybe you're outside and the wind is blowing the trees and stuff, because that movement like eats up somehow, I guess, eats up Zoom bandwidth. All trying to keep track of the motion, where like if you're just kind of in a static place, it's all kind of a mystery to me. But apparently, so you just might be aware of not having movement behind you. Yes, and another cloud-related thing is I encourage you to chant along. I looked up today, everybody choosing to get here early for morning chanting service looks like you were chanting along. A lot of times, like on Tuesdays, I notice when we have the recitation, and actually in the mornings when we sit Zazen, and then we online, and then we do the Heart Sutra and stuff. Like, a lot of times people just sit there and listen. I know, because it's weird, you're at home and nobody can hear you, so it's not like you're really joining in with the chanting, so it's a little weird. But the practice is the chanting, not just the listening. So I just encourage you to, investigate that practice. And one little fun thing that you can adopt as you chant, whether you're in the Dirt Zendo or the cloud, is, I was thinking about this, the best way to describe it. It's like, as a sangha, as one body, imagine we're trying to fill a sail, and we're trying to, so that our sailboat is moving along the water, quickly and at a constant speed. And it's our breath that fills that sail. Now, what we want to do, each of us, is basically take as much of an inhale as we can, and kind of blow chant for as long as we can on that breath, and then take a nice big breath and, you know, chant again on that breath as long as we can. And as a Sangha, we keep that sail full because we're all taking breaths at different times, because your breath, your natural breath, and how long you have to chant, you know, is going to happen at different times. So you can break just right in the middle of a sentence, but then we're not all breaking at the same time, which tends to happen certain points in the chant. Everybody goes, and I just imagine the sail kind of like, like at that point. And one, you know, the prime example of this is the ancestors. When we're chanting the ancestors, it's, you know, great teacher, Punika, great teacher, Patachara. There's a very natural inclination to take a breath at the end of each line. Great teacher, Punika, great teacher, Patachara, great teacher, Bada. So then there's like, everybody's going to, you know, the rhythm or the energy of it is going to be broken between each ancestor. And the whole point is we want like this, we want the ancestor line to be unbroken. We want it to be like continuous. So each of us like, great teacher, Punika, great teacher, Patachara, great teacher, Bada, great teacher, Damadina, great teacher, Sumana, great teacher, Kisogotami, you know, like you can even miss whole syllables because everybody else will be keeping that chant up. And a part of that whole breath practice is that when you take deep breaths, your whole body calms down. Like it sends a message to your body that everything is okay. So it actually has like calming effects on your nervous system and hormones. Anyway, any like comments or questions about any of that? Chanting felt very strange at first for me, Livia says, but then I realized it helped calm down the monkey mind. Yeah, I think it's a cool practice. So, you know, I encourage you to do it at home, even if it feels awkward. Cool. Then, Cedar, do you want to draw a question for today? There's small ones, there's big ones. Didn't I answer this one already? Sorry, I'm not looking at you. Romeo, what was the beginning of your Zen practice? How did your Zen journey start? I mean, I feel like I've talked about that one an awful lot. On to a different question. Okay. And yes, Livia says there's a podcast about that. If you want to know, there's a bunch of podcasts about that actually. I swear I've done this one too. How to tell when your practice is languishing versus the normal ebb and flow of practice.
Yeah.
Now, I usually write down on these because I keep them because they're good. You know, maybe in the future I do a podcast on them or something. Answered. Okay. So then if they end up back in there, then they won't be confused. All right. Let's try again. Okay. Okay. So the person who asked this is here. So if I've answered it already, let me know. I heard some teachers say that putting a smile on our face can help us into a more open and happier state. I've heard other teachers suggest this is actually not such a great practice, and that it isn't good to wear a fake forced smile. Does that sound familiar? Yeah. That is very good. But I mean, the basic answer is like, yes and no and sometimes and
right.
of course. I had an experience of this once at a session. And I think this practice has been given by the teachers to people more than once, or more than just me. And I can't remember if it was given to me individually or just the teacher suggested it for everybody. But I had been, I don't know, like, I mean, it's very easy for some of us in our practice to get rather grim, especially during a meditation retreat. You know, it gets very hard and you're just like, and I don't know. I was at a point in my monk practice where I felt discouraged. I didn't know if I was ever going to make any progress. And I don't know. So it was just a very heavy, obligatory, grim feeling. And so I got this recommendation to smile, right? And so I just, you know, at first it was very awkward to do, but then I just sat there and for the rest of the session, you know, I was just like, smiling. And, you know, it changed things. It really did. Like, I feel like our bodies and minds are not two, which is why the Zazen posture itself is significant. I've been thinking lately about how even, even non-Buddhists who have known nothing about Buddhism at all love to put a little Buddha statue in their garden, right? Because that posture looks peaceful. And it looks like, my husband was saying, it looks like you have self-restraint. So like, you know, the physical posture says that. And I feel like it communicates that to some extent to our minds. So I think that, yeah, I mean, putting a smile on your face can be powerful. And I know people have heard me tell about this this comic before, but it's obviously very appropriate for the topic. I don't know if anybody knows the comic Zits about like the big gangly teenage boy. Anyway, he wakes up and he's all like miserable and, you know, eating his breakfast and his mom says something like, you know, if you just smile, you know, and so he puts this smile on his face and he's like, oh, look at me. I'm smiling. I'm so happy now. Oh, and then like he walks out the front door and then he's like, dang, that helped. But then at the same time, it's almost like any of our practices and teachings can be our medicine, right? So sometimes they're appropriate and sometimes not appropriate. And sometimes, just like medicine, they might actually be harmful instead of helpful. And I think that's when, you know, we are feeling something difficult, you know, grief or anger or whatever, and we just don't want to deal with it. We just want it to go away, and therefore we're gonna just force ourselves to be different, which is like not, yeah, it's not, it's like kind of bypassing practice, right? It's trying to just remake our state of mind, which is honestly sometimes where metta practice. So metta practice is like, you know, sitting and calling someone to mind, initially starting with someone who's easy, then moving towards someone who's more difficult and trying to include ourselves in there at some point, calling someone to mind and wishing them well, trying to feel goodwill toward them. May you be free from fear and anxiety. May you be at ease. May you be happy. Kind of really feeling that. And this can be a very interesting and helpful medicine for like fear and anxiety or, you know, resentment. And it can be a very powerful practice. But it's also like, if this is the only tool in our arsenal, if you will, our arsenal, at least meta, basically, if we're like, I'm feeling icky feelings, I'm gonna do some meta, right? Like we could use any of these things as a as an opposition to dealing with or facing difficult feelings. I'm just gonna fix it. I'm just gonna do this practice that makes me feel better, or forget it, or redirects the mind. That's what Zen doesn't have, a whole lot of those kind of redirection practices. Our practice is primarily introspection. It's primarily like, what is going on? Be with it. See it completely. In which case, yeah, it's sometimes, so it's almost like the smile can be like treating symptoms. But ultimately, we want to look deeper, like, what is going on? What is there something that we can let go of? What is something that we can see through that is pulling us into negative feelings? So,
Oh,
go ahead with,
no,
yeah.
right, just cutting in. I know that as a Rose City clown, former, a smile relaxes the muscles on the face, and of course, Thich Nhat Hanh reminds people of that. But I recognize people by their walks, and I live in a community where I also recognize women by their do's. So when they change their hairdos, so I figure who wants to live with a curmudgeon? I try to keep at least I'm glad to be here. I'm glad you work here kind of look on my face. And it can be puzzling to people that sometimes I have to correct, like, this is part of your job as housekeeper. And then I'll still say hello in Spanish or something. But words count. And a longtime colleague of mine in Eugene said, oh, yes, cloud worship works for a lot of people since COVID. People that maybe can't get physically to the community. But I'm so glad we call it cloud. Her group calls it pajama church, and I really
Oh
thank
I'm a church. Thank you for sharing that, Ruth Ann. I'm gonna remember that one for sure. Yes. Sometimes you're at home and you are in the cloud. And then sometimes you're probably in pajama church, right? All right. Yeah, Leah.
So I thought that the instructions for a session were to not look people in the eye, which is I eventually kind of understood. I think I understand. Let me see if I do. That it was a kind of relief from socially relating. And I find a smile for me is part of social relating, and it's a mask that I put up a lot of times. It's just part of the mask. It's not really me. It's just because I'm making the monkey face that says hi, you know. So I'm not sure now. Like you said, it can help in session, but now I'm thinking that if I'm smiling,
But you're not
I'm not
smiling
really.
at anyone. Nobody's looking at you, which feels really weird because it's like a smile that has nothing to do with anybody else. And it feels like you're kind of dumb. Like you're just like it's like it's different because then you have to be like, where is this coming from? Like, why are my muscles doing,
Who's
it's a
this
different
for?
experience than when it's just a, yeah, the social response.
I just want to make sure I
Yes,
understand.
yes. Jinryu.
I don't understand the origin of the question necessarily, but I will tell you that a couple of things about the smiling. The first is that when I was studying yoga and intensely, one of the things we were taught when we meditated was to slightly turn the corners of our mouth up, because that is the way the Buddha looks when he's meditating. And it's not that hard to do when I think about it. And it makes a lot more sense to me than to sit there and meditate, with a big frown on my face. I don't know what, anyway, I don't know if that's helpful or not, but we were taught to do that. The thing about not looking people in the eye at Sesshin, the way I understand it, and the way I understood it, because the first time it's done to you, it is weird and you feel weird. But what I began to learn was that I am who I am, and I am okay. Whether you smile at me or not, it makes no difference. Whether, you look me in the eye or not, I am still here. And I'm doing just fine. And so to me, that is the value of not connecting with each other the way we normally would with eye connection and a smile. But I also know I learned something from you, Demio. I don't exactly know how to put this into words related to what we're talking about, but just this, and maybe it's just more of a better way to be socially, but when I walk through that Zendo door, putting aside, making and setting an intention to put aside the things that have been bothering me, the things that have worried me, my troubles, and just greet people with a level of warmth, and that usually includes a smile. And I always try to practice that now, since you and I had a conversation about it, which I know you don't remember, but it had an impression on me. So that's it. Thanks.
Yeah, I know that when I sometimes will do that tiny little, it's not even really a smile, it's kind of a non-frown, while sitting. And for me, it feels associated with Evo says, I don't see metta practice as redirecting, in my experience, actually initiates a process that invites and allows me to open even further to acknowledging, holding, and working through difficult feelings, emotions, et cetera, about myself, someone else, or others. So that's a great point. Like all of these things can be used kind of, what if you will, appropriately. And they can be misused. I think that's a great point. Like, yeah, it can be used as that kind of redirect process. And you might even have an ongoing practice and find that, like, sometimes you do it one way and sometimes you do it another, right? Sometimes you're kind of misusing or spiritually bypassing with a tool. Yes. So then if I have my mild non-frown when I am sitting. It's like it helps turn down my self-concern. Like I'm sitting there and I have my level of concern for my current issues or problems or projects, or maybe just my meditation, my zazen, my, like, and that's what kind of leads to that kind of stern attitude. And then when I smile, it's kind of just like the whole point, like who? The whole point is like who? There's no one who is going to gain by this practice. There's no one who is like flawed. It's like approaching our meditation with that sternness is actually just kind of perpetuating that small self idea. I feel like the smile kind of breaks that a little. Benny.
Just a couple of things real quickly. There is, and I think somebody said something like this, but there is scientific evidence that if you smile, just slightly smile, that there's a direct connection to something in your nervous system that promotes a sense of well-being or calm. Excuse me. Somebody once sent that to me. And I thought it was really interesting. And one other thing, I find myself naturally like out here in the cloud when people are, when students like me are either giving a talk or raising their hand to say something. I find myself smiling and it's not a big, toothy smile, but and I've kind of noticed that because I every now and then I see myself right there. And so I ask myself, so why are you doing that? I think that it's kind of an empathy thing. That I'm not the bravest of public speakers. And so when somebody else is up there sharing something, and many times it's something personal, I think I'm smiling because I want them to feel like I'm listening and yeah, I hear you. And it's kind of like wanting to make a connection from out in the cloud. And I don't know if I would do the same if I were in the dirt zendo, but I probably would. I don't know.
You probably would.
Yeah. So I just thought I'd bring that.
You. Yoli.
I was thinking about this the other day because especially during Kinhana, sometimes I remember to at least have somewhat of a smile. And I notice that it actually relaxes me because when you're not smiling, you tend to clench your teeth, and that sort of affects the rest of your body. And so by smiling, it releases some of the muscles. And as a physician, especially an osteopathic physician that uses her hands, some of my patients that had TMJ had a dysfunction, a bodily dysfunction. Sometimes it was a leg length discrepancy. And then vice versa, when you're clenching your teeth, it also creates a dysfunction in your body. And so I just want to throw that out there because I have noticed that when I stop clenching my teeth because it takes a lot of effort to close your mouth and keep it shut. But if you do that, it just relaxes those muscles. So anyways, there's something to think about.
Cool. All right. We have
Oh, sorry. It's not, yeah, I was just asking what
fifth.
TMJ was.
Okay.
It's a mandibular
EMJ is a what?
temporomandibular dysfunction, temporomandibular joint dysfunction. So it causes pain, it causes rigidity,
In your jaw,
in your
yeah.
jaw.
All right. Okay. Right. Okay. This one actually says answered. I won't put them back in the envelope this time. Sorry.
That's funny.
I have to have another Question writing session. How do you break out of the six realms as states of mind? Yeah, I got a podcast on that too. Just, you know, let me know if you ever get tired of that or just like, yeah. So the first answer is I have a podcast on that. Right. So just in case there's anybody here who's not familiar with the six realms, that is the traditional Buddhist cosmology, which Buddhism actually kind of inherited from a lot of the indigenous Indian religions of the time. So, but it has its own twist on it. So the six realms, so it's seen as the universe is composed of six realms of existence where you might be reborn after you die. That there is heaven, but you don't stay in any of the realms forever. Your karma, the cause and effect that led you to your current state, if it's positive, if you've, you know, lived a really good life, even if you've lived a very spiritual life, you might be reborn in the heaven realm, but eventually that karma runs out and then you're reborn somewhere else. So there's heaven, which is actually kind of like a wonderful and spiritual place. It's not just about like having everything you like, but it's kind of sublime. And then next to that, there's the realm of the fighting demigods, if you will, the Asuras, who were once in heaven, but now they've fallen out. And it says there's a wish fulfilling tree in heaven that you can go to and you can get anything you like. But the wish fulfilling tree, the trunk of it, is in the Asura realm. And the Asuras can see heaven. So this is the only realm that can see heaven. So they can see heaven. The tree is in their realm, but so they can't get the fruits. It's just in heaven. So like the Asuras are just, their realm is not that unfortunate, but they're just jealous. They just want more. So this is like, and I guess as I go and describe, I love the mythology. I love the imagery and stuff. It really brings it alive. You know, particularly in Zen, particularly in modern Buddhism, we also look at these as just metaphors for states of mind. So, you know, I don't believe literally in rebirth and that you go to these different realms or whatever, but I can't prove that we don't. So it's not important that you believe it or you don't believe it in terms of your practice, but it is very rich imagery we can learn a lot from. So if you think about the state of mind for the heaven realm, frankly, I think most of us here are in the heaven realm. Most of us are like, we are very fortunate. And so we're kind of like, if we practice, kind of have to kind of make ourselves practice, you know, because it's like, it's a beautiful day. I could be out doing something else. Like, it's so there's a kind of a struggle between just enjoying our lives and practicing, but we're not quite in the heaven. If we were in the heaven realm, we wouldn't even bother. But so it's from the Buddhist point of view, it's not ideal to be in the heaven realm because then you don't practice, and then you just enjoy yourself until something changes, and then it's looked at as the worst pain there is, worse than hell. Is you've been in the heaven realm and now you're losing it. So that's the mythology anyway. In the heaven realm, then if you're going to try to get yourself out of the heaven realm, I don't know, you dwell on impermanence? Like, yeah, you basically dwell on impermanence. There's a Buddha in each realm waiting to help liberate the beings in the realm. And the Buddha in heaven is just... he's just playing a stringed instrument. He's just kind of waiting. Like, you know, it'll happen when it happens. So in some ways, like the heaven realm is the worst place to be, but it's the best place to be too. So then you got the Asura realm, where they're just like envious all the time. And they're just, you know, so that state of mind is obviously like this kind of dissatisfaction with what we have. We have enough, but we want more. We want what that person has. We want that thing. We want that status. We want that power. And so, you know, we do all kinds of mean, selfish things in order to get that. And the Buddha in that realm has a sword, kind of speaking the Asura's language, but I like to think of it as kind of teaching a code of like honor and self-respect and self-discipline that, you know, could curtail those, that, you know, constant striving. And then there's the beast realm. So that there's, well, the three upper realms. So the other, on the other side, this is pictured. You get the Asura realm over here. The other fortunate realm is the human realm. So, I mean, I guess technically we are in the human realm. And the human realm is this like a quintessential mixed bag. And it's defined by like constant change, right? Like sometimes we kind of have a sense of heaven. Sometimes we have a sense of hell. Sometimes we have a sense of the other realms. So we kind of don't know what to do. But it is viewed as the best realm for practice because it's not so comfortable that we get complacent, and it's not so painful and miserable that we can't practice. So the human realm, in a sense, that's where we want to end up. But we want to encourage ourselves to practice when we're there. Then the lower realms, so the very bottom, there is hell. And the Buddhists have incredible descriptions of hell that, you know, rival the Christians. Like it's all kinds of different hells, different levels, different kinds of punishment, all kinds of stuff. But you are not stuck in hell either. And it's said that you are reborn in hell when you essentially say yes to anger and ill will, and it develops into hatred. So you have like, now you have not just like, oh, anger arises, ill will arises, but like you have decided to make it a way of life, and you go deeply into that. And then there's, you know, you're really trapped there and just miserable. But to get out, I think it's like it's like healing water or something that the Buddha has. So to get out of that state of mind, which I think all of us can be familiar with if we're really just caught up in just, you know, anger, rage, resentment, whatever, the way out of it is letting go of that, of, you know, we do what we have to do, but nurturing that resentment is not helpful. So we can get out of the hell realm by letting go of our hatred and anger. And then there is the other lower realm, it's the beast realm, which is beings, or when we just are kind of reduced to the basic, like we just want to eat and sleep and have sex and just amuse ourselves. And it's just very basic. It's just, we have no aspirations. And it's said in the beast realm, you're reborn in the beast realm when you've just ignored the laws of karma. You just like, you're not concerned about the effects of your actions. Yeah. So you're just reborn in the beast realm. And getting out of the beast realm is to like actually learn about the laws of karma, to kind of raise yourself out of that state through greater awareness and study, essentially. And then the other lower realm is the hungry ghost realm, which we have a festival about that in the fall, where you're reborn there when you are very stingy. And you know, you kind of think of what's the difference between that and like the Asura realm, but it's like the Asura realm, like you have enough. You just have this like appetite for like, you just want more. You want what that other person has. And the hungry ghost realm really suffers from a sense of lack, right? Like we hold on to everything because we're just afraid of loss, afraid of not having enough, afraid of being taken advantage of. So in the Hungry Ghost realm, the cosmology is like, you know, well, almost the richest cosmology of all the realms, where all the beings are like, either have teeny, teeny, teeny little mouths, and they can't get any food in their mouth. And if they drink anything, it's like the heat of their breath evaporates the water that gets in their little tiny hole. So they can't eat or drink. So they have immense hunger and thirst. Or there's other reasons, like every time they approach the food or water, it like turns into flames and pus and stuff. So they're searching and they're longing and they're hungry. And they're always like essentially searching for the wrong thing, right? And when we are in the Hungry Ghost realm, it's the realm of addiction. It's the realm of just longing. And if only I had this, and if only I had that, if only I had that. When the real peace comes from practice, the real peace comes from the Dharma, not from something external. So when the hungry ghosts recognize that, when they start to practice, maybe start to practice some generosity or something. The hungry ghost realm might be one of the ones where it has like, they're across the table from each other with the long spoons, and they could feed each other, but they can't bring themselves to do it. It's that kind of realm. So, and I do have a little, I have a little booklet about it. And then there's also the podcast where it's essentially, I'm just reading that book out loud. But it's a really fruitful way to look at our different mind states and recognize, and like, I'm kind of in this, because it's not like there's really only six states of mind, but sometimes it kind of feels like, what realm are you in right now? You can recognize what realm are you in and what might be helpful to get yourself out of that. Well, that brings us to 12:15. So abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water, the mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, mahaprajna paramita.
Thank you, Dorio.
Thank you all for coming.
Bye, everybody.